Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. What do you want to hear on the Charlotte Talks podcast? Fill out our quick listener survey right now on WFAE.org. Thanks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In the divided nation in which we live, could the solution to healing that division be found in literature, in poetry? Tracy K. Smith believes so, and she holds a special belief in poetry, as she should, given that she is the Poet Laureate of the United States. She says poems speak to everything. Poetry reminds us that we are unique, and if we believe that about ourselves, we can believe it about other people. But I will let her explain. Tracy K. Smith is with us for the hour in which we will talk about her philosophy, her poetry, and more. And later, we'll broaden this discussion of how the arts can have a positive impact on society to include music, and one piece of music in particular, Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, itself based on a poem. Tracy K. Smith, welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program. Good to see you.
It's good to see you.
You look just like yourself. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can get to us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And if you want to see this poet laureate who should be on national television every day, you can watch us on Facebook Live and you'll see what I'm talking about. How does one become the poet laureate of the United States?
You know, it's a question I'm asked, and the answer is I really don't know. It's one of those mysterious processes.
So you just get a phone call one day?
You get a phone call.
Really? And what was your reaction when you got the call?
I was hugely honored, but I was terrified, surprised, and I had to kind of process things. I had to say, let me just breathe and take a minute to decide what this would mean, what I could offer in this role.
So you had no, you had no warning that this was coming your way, that the phone rings, you pick it up, you actually answer calls, the numbers of which you don't recognize.
I know, right? I was curious.
So they just called you up, and did they explain what they expect of you as a poet laureate, or did you know that because that's your job, you're a poet?
I knew a little bit, but I didn't know, for example, that there are really only two requirements, and that is that you give a poetry reading in the beginning of the term, and a closing lecture. I always knew that the Poets Laureate that I remembered did other things, and they went out and they had poetry projects and they engaged with people around poems, and I've learned that that's something that the library is eager to support you in doing, mm-hmm. but there's no, you know, charge to do that.
The library being the Library of Congress, the librarian of the Library of Congress makes this choice every year, although you're extending your poet laureateship, if that's the word, for an additional year because you're in the middle of the project that you decided to do. And the Library of Congress does this. This didn't begin in 1791. This is a relatively new invention, poet laureate. Why do we have one?
Well, we have one to raise the public awareness of the art form of poetry and its pleasures and its relevance to our lives. I think that the original position, the consultant to poetry for the Library of Congress, I think that person did some work. I think they answered questions that people wrote to the library about poetry or about poetics. And it's since morphed into something that's a little bit more about enrichment.
So there's several poet laureates living today, former poet laureates. Did you all get together and talk? Did you talk to any of them before you decided to take the job? Did you talk to them? Are you talking to them now? Or did they give you advice? How does all this work?
I got a really beautiful series of calls and emails after this was announced. I did reach out to Natasha Trethewey, who is a friend of mine and who served in this position a few Poets Laureate ago, and got some advice from her about what does it feel like, how should I envision what this might mean. And then I got some lovely, I had a phone call the day before the news was announced from Juan Felipe Herrera, who had been in this position just prior to me. He actually was funny because he said, oh, when the news hit, I was at home in Fresno and there were press corps on my lawn. It was like the Nobel Prize had been announced. And so I went to bed thinking, okay, maybe I should prepare for this, and that's not at all what happened.
You have a Pulitzer Prize. How does the phone call that you got asking you to be the poet laureate compared to the phone call you must have got when they told you you won the Pulitzer?
Well, it's a really different thing. But actually, there's no phone call from the Pulitzer. That's okay. One of those things where the press breaks the news and you see your name in the paper or on the website. And then a few weeks later, the Pulitzer Committee confirms this with a nice letter in the mail. This is about, I see this position as being about service, as kind of looking up for my own work and thinking about how what I love and what I believe can be a kind of offering to other people who may have no experience with poetry or people who might feel estranged from poetry.
Well, let's talk about that, because we live in this Snapchat culture, and although we listen to music all the time, most people do at least, and their music is full of lyrics. Lyrics are not poetry. Rap is not necessarily poetry, although there are elements of it, because there's rhythm and there's rhyme. A lot of people find poetry difficult to approach. I was an English minor. I found it very difficult to approach and very intimidating, because we would read these poems and then the professor would say, "Now, what do you think he or she, the poet, was trying to say here?" And I was always reluctant to say anything because I didn't want to be wrong.
Well, I think that's exactly what happens. I think that's the trap of, I don't know how we are taught or how we're evaluated on having learned. So we are urged to imagine that a poet is trying to say something as opposed to creating something, creating an experience that's holistic. And we're also made to suspect that the poem wants to prove to us how much smarter it is than we are. And I don't think that's true. I also don't think that education and an understanding of poetic terminology and history is a boost to any other, insight you might bring to a poem. I don't think it's required. I think a poem, like a song, meets you where you are, causes you to hear, think, feel, and imagine things, and those are valid responses.
You've called it a shortcut to honest conversation. So for those of people who find poetry difficult to approach, how do they get to that point of view?
I start by saying, what do you notice? And there's nothing too small to notice. Oh, the title makes me think of this thing, but then the first line of the poem makes me think of this other thing. Well, that's an effect, and that's something that isn't accidental. What's the next thing that you notice? Oh, a lot of the verbs in this poem come from the context of, machinery, but it's a poem about love. Okay, that's not accidental either. What happens when you think about love in the context of, industry? And you just move forward in that way.
New York Times Sunday Magazine has a little poem in it every week. There's an explanation from the person who chose the poem about what, I guess, they got from the poem. And quite often I'll read the poem and not get that at all. And I'm thinking, where did that come from? Where did that insight spring from? Are they right? Are they?
Well, I Terrence Hayes is the person who chooses and comments on those poems, and I think he's right, and I think you're right. I think that when I encounter a poem at one moment in my life, I have a reaction. If I come back to it a few years or even a few months later, I might see something or hear something different as a result of what I'm now aware of in myself or in the world. I like to take those little comments as, okay, this is something I can return to and find or seek in the poem after I've had my own organic experience of it.
I've stopped reading the explanations.
Read them after. But I also, I don't mean to say that anything goes in a poem. Okay. I think poets work hard to ward off egregious misreadings. They're striving for a certain kind of clarity. They're striving where it's important to say, where in this context, the speaker is a single individual, perhaps we know things about the speaker. And then there are areas where a kind of ambiguity might be productive. Just as in life, there are things we don't quite know 100%.
But I would think, because you're not writing prose, there's a certain rigor to poetry, that every word is carefully chosen.
Right. It's chosen for different reasons, right? I like to believe that there are different kinds of scents that we are susceptible to. Mm. We think logic is the, you know, preeminent sense. And poems often say, okay, you might find logic here, but it might be secondary to sound, or it might be secondary to the emotional current that's going to catch you up. And if you're willing to say, okay, feeling supersedes logic, then maybe you can get somewhere.
You've said that the portal to honest conversation through poetry and by extension through literature allows us to be open and listen and to be curious. Do you think that's still true in a world where we all seem to be seeking out, at least in the news, points of view that underline and solidify our own points of view? Do we want to be open and curious anymore?
I think we need to want to be. But I agree with you. Our lives are infested with alerts and messages and advertising pitches. I kind of have this feeling that most of the technology that we live with at hand is merely a vehicle for products and product placement and advertising.
Sure it is. And services. And we're the product.
Yeah. Well, we're also sort of courted into imagining that our comfort, our snap judgments, our gut reactions, or even our well-informed opinions are more important than anyone else's and anything else's. Our vocabulary for human interaction has been shaped by the terms that come with these, you know, these apps and products and devices. And sometimes they make us think that being interested in other people is a kind of distraction from what's really important. And I think poetry helps to dissuade us of that.
Because it is coming from the poet's point of view. And I know that your work has a particular point of view on a lot of things. It has to. Otherwise, you wouldn't be writing it. You wouldn't feel compelled to write it. But do you think that if you sit down in a quiet place someplace and read a poem that does have a point of view other than your own, or pieces of information that you haven't been exposed to, that vehicle, the poem, is an easier way to access that other point of view and not feel threatened by it?
If it's a good poem, I think it is a good way of doing that. And I'll tell you why. I think a good poem comes perhaps in part from an idea or a perspective, but it has to be willing to surrender some of the certainty that sets that perspective into motion in pursuit of a larger kind of discovery or revelation. And the journey that the poet or the poem speaker is going on toward that discovery is something that the reader can participate in. And so maybe where you think you're going is not where you're going to end up. And then, you know, we also have a kind of comfort because you can read a poem slowly. You can stop. You can say, oh, I don't get it or I don't like that, but I'm curious. Let me keep going. And it's words on a page that become a voice in your head, but you're not on the spot. No one's filming you. No one's recording you. No one's going to hold you to your reaction. And it can be a kind of a process.
Tracy K. Smith is our guest. She's a poet laureate of the United States, author of several books of poetry, including her latest, Wade in the Water. When we come back, we'll hear something from Wade in the Water. We'll have you read something from that. And also want to talk about what you're doing as poet laureate, traveling the country, going places where writers don't usually go and saying, here are some poems. Did they speak to you? What do you hear in them? We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tracy K. Smith is with us. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, the Poet Laureate of the United States, about to go into her second year in that position. She also teaches the Creative Writing Is It Workshop or Studies. Just create it. What do you at Princeton?
It's the program.
The program at Princeton, although she's taken a break from doing that, so she can be on this program today. And you are, as Poet Laureate, One of the things that you wanted to do was go around the country, and that the way I positioned that before the break are your words, to go to places where writers don't usually go and say, here are some poems. Do they speak to you? What do you hear from them? Is there a wrong answer in that question, in those questions, and what kind of reaction are you getting from people as you go to what you call underserved areas that aren't exposed to a lot of poetry?
Mm-hmm. In the setting of, hey, let's get to know each other, let's talk about poems in our lives, there isn't a wrong answer. And I'm mostly curious to hear what voices that I've lived with for some time as a writer, or even some of my own poems, have to say to people who come from a different, landscape with mm-hmm. different kinds of concerns. And it's been really wonderful. Sometimes the perspectives that emerge renew poems that I've loved by giving to me in a different way.
Mm. Where have you been? I know you've been to South Carolina, Jim Clyburn took you around mm-hmm. to the low country of South Carolina to do some of these readings. Where else have you been on this quest
of yours? I was in Kentucky. Okay. That was the last trip that I took. I was in Bowling Green, Kentucky at a men's addiction rehab center. Mm-hmm. I visited New Haven, Kentucky, a small community library. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to blank on the...
That's all right.
but another community center in the state. I was also in New Mexico, where I visited an Air Force base and a Native American school.
Well, you have a familiarity with Air Force, because your father was in the Air Force for years until he became an engineer on the Hubble Space Telescope program. And your mom, as I understand it, was a former school teacher when you were a child, and you grew up in California. In your memoir, one of your friends describes you, your family, as being just like the Huxtables. So where does poetry fit into all of that? I mean, were you encouraged to read poetry? How did you first come to it?
Well, my dad loved reading. He was an engineer who also loved, literature. And whenever I was bored, he would say, oh, look at all these books. Go read a book. And sometimes I would obey. And I found that I loved the sounds of words, even if I didn't understand exactly what they were saying. And as I got older, I was encouraged to continue writing once I started showing people poems. And then when I got to college, I realized there was a world of contemporary poetry, and that was a world I wanted to belong to.
So I'm going to make a lot of assumptions here, and you can just slap me silly if I'm wrong. but your father, being in the Air Force and later an engineer on the Hubble Space Telescope program, although he was a reader, it seems to me he had a certain sense of logicalness to his life. Your mom, former school teacher, probably creative, very religious, I understand. Mm-hmm. How did the values that they instilled in you as a child, how do they inform your poetry?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. I should know, because I've written some things about my family. But I think that the sense of curiosity that my dad had about how things worked, he was fascinated by just the natural order and the scientific order, and he wanted to know how to build and make and create. And I think I loved watching him do those things. And in fact, one of the first poems I wrote in college was a poem that was about him building a piece of furniture, but it was also a process that allowed me to kind of feel like I was building something in language. Hmm. And maybe that metaphor sort of stuck for me. And my mother, both of my parents were faithful, but my mother had a really strong sense of need and belief that permeated every aspect of her and mm-hmm. our lives. And I think that sense of trust in something mysterious also shapes my sense of what I'm doing in language. I don't think it's just me. I don't think it's just my imagination. I'm hoping I can find
something bigger,
a current of something else.
Mm-hmm. I think one of your, I don't know if it was your first one or not, but one of the books that you have, one of your collections is called Life on Mars, and that was kind of based on or a tribute to your father's work mm-hmm. on the telescope. Your latest is Wade in the Water, which is a popular song, but it's also a spiritual, and it goes way back. Why the title?
I'd been working on the poems in this book for a while, and I didn't know what would unify them other than this sense that compassion is a capacity we need to beef up in our lives as 21st century people. And I was looking at history. I had found some areas within the history of the Civil War that were compelling, and so I have a long poem that speaks to that. And then I went to coastal Georgia, and I attended a ring shout. And one of the women, her name is Bertha McKnight, she's a beautiful person, greeted me and everyone else who walked into this community center by saying, "I love you," and giving everyone a hug. And it didn't feel fake. It didn't feel like her shtick. It felt like this beautiful human gesture. And because of the history that I'd also been preoccupied with, which is painful and often under acknowledged, I had a lot of conflicting feelings, and that gesture really healed something. And I came home from that trip, and I couldn't stop playing Wade in the Water, which was one of the songs that they had performed that night. And I wanted to dig in a little bit deeper to where my reaction came from. And so writing a poem helped me to do that. And that poem seemed to want to be the prevailing ethos for the book.
In the break, I asked if you would read something from that collection, and I don't know what you're going to read, but I'm sure you've made a decision.
Well, now I'll read this poem, and it's for the Geechee Gullah ring shouters who were the performers. Wade in the Water. One of the women greeted me. "I love you," she said. She didn't know me, but I believed her, and a terrible new ache rolled over in my chest, like in a room where the drapes have been swept back. "I love you. I love you," as she continued down the hall past other strangers, each feeling pierced suddenly by pillars of heavy light. "I love you," throughout the performance, in every hand clap, every stomp. "I love you," in the rusted iron chains someone was made to drag until love let them be unclasped and left empty in the center of the ring. "I love you," in the water where they pretended to wade, singing that old blood-deep song that dragged us to those banks and cast us in. "I love you," the angles of it scraping at each throat, shouldering past the swirling dust motes in those beams of light that whatever we now knew we could let ourselves feel knew to climb. Oh, woods. Oh, dogs. Oh, tree. Oh, gun. Oh, girl, run. Oh, miraculous many gone. Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, oh, Lord, is this love the trouble you promised?
There is music in that, not just based on the song. There's music in that. When you wrote that, what was going through your mind? I mean, how do you come to that place?
Well, you can kind of hear me thinking through the anecdote, mm-hmm. right? So I'm in this place and someone says this thing. And the first thing I did as a writer was to try and find an image that could sort of convey that feeling of shock and pain and joy. And so this sense of like a room being opened up inside of me mm-hmm. was the image that I landed on. That image became helpful to me later. You hear that sense of light coming back. This is what I do when I'm writing and I run out of things to say. I go back and see what I've said to see if I can further utilize anything. And then, something rhythmic begins to happen. That catalog at the end of the poem, I think, creates this opportunity for something to break in. So I wanted to ride that momentum. And the images that come in are images of, like, slavery. Like, I imagine someone escaping or somebody right. with the intention of escaping. And that larger history really becomes the grounding for the poem. I love the song that says, you know, "Wade in the water, God's going to trouble the water." And it comes from this sense of troubling being, you know, a benediction. I think the poem is interested in that word in both ways, you know, something that is reassuring and something that is probably hard work, too.
You tell your students that a poem isn't just an expression of all the things that you're feeling, but it's a set of choices that you're making in language, so that every description, every question, every statement, every turn is a choice that opens and closes possibilities. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Well, it's the same principle as, like, okay, I'm choosing what steps to take in going somewhere. And in going one place, I'm going away from another. If we can look at the specific words and turns and questions and whatever else is happening in the language that we are building as part of a journey, it's exciting to trust that we're getting somewhere. And if you get somewhere, it doesn't feel fruitful. You've got to back up and see if you can get somewhere else.
Are you attracted to poetry as a writer because it is more difficult, perhaps, than prose, or because it can be more impactful than prose because you are working with fewer words and you have to be very specific with what you do?
I think you've got to be specific in prose, and I don't think prose is easier. I've written a book of prose, and it was hard. I think I like poetry because it is rooted in these moments of insight or revelation. So a single poem, even if it's telling a story, the story becomes secondary to this moment of something happening, something kind of rising to the surface. I love that poems are rooted in images that are powerful, that are visceral. I love that metaphor is this really amazing tool that allows you to zero in on how the most powerful events in our lives are powerful because something has been disrupted or distorted. And so metaphor allows me to say, I know love is supposed to feel like this, but in my case, it felt like this completely other thing. Let me tell you what that is by telling you about something that doesn't seem like it should apply.
Because you say that poetry has been a way to bring voice to the unsayable, the untranslatable. Explain that.
Well, we live with a lot of the unsayables and the untranslatables, those feelings that are big and murky or troubling or, you know, that we don't feel free enough to share or even articulate clearly to ourselves. I love poems because sometimes I can find those feelings in the words of someone else, and somehow that becomes a vocabulary for those areas in my life. And I write poems because I'm interested in doing some of the work to find language that can help me name and claim the feelings that make me who I am.
Tracy K. Smith is our guest. She's the Poet Laureate of the United States. And I would be remiss if I did not mention that she will be reading portions of her work and discussing her work both tonight at 8 at Pease Auditorium at CPCC and then tomorrow morning at 11 at the Halton Theater on the campus in the Tate Building, I believe, at CPCC. She's here for the Sensory Festival, which we'll talk about in the next segment of the program. There is a poem that I've heard you read sections of on the PBS NewsHour, among other places, in your book, Wade in the Water, called I Will Tell You the Truth About This, I Will Tell You All About It. And it uses the letters, among other things, it uses the letters of African-American soldiers writing to President Lincoln about their service. Mm-hmm. And that later on they write about their difficulty in getting their pensions, et cetera. And as I understand it, essentially, you have used their words. This is like Ken Burns. You have you have used their words and, as a poet, just gotten out of their way.
Yeah.
How did you come to that decision? And what makes it a poem if it's really just words from their letters? How does that work?
Well, I came to that material thinking I would write a more conventional poem that I had, you know, processed some information and decided to comment upon it or speak to it. But the more I read those letters and these depositions, the less I felt like I had to add to that. There was so much urgency, dignity, so much writing on these voices, and they didn't feel remote to me. They didn't feel like they were 150 years old. And I thought, I want simply to curate a chorus of these voices and excerpts so that I can find people to listen to them with. And I think it becomes a poem because the voices are employed in such a way that I think they're working together to tell a story. And the story, while meaningful in every single individual instance, it gains a sort of dramatic or even mythic power when they speak together, when I can hear a dozen people saying the same thing.
Can you share some of it?
Sure.
I'll put you on the spot here.
It's a long poem, so I'm going to read. I'll read you one section right. Where that that choral effect, I think, comes through, because it's not one letter, but rather a series of excerpts from people's letters to President Lincoln.
Okay. I'll just tell you that we have about 2 minutes left as you search for that in the
book. Excellent, sir.
Okay.
My son went in the 54th Regiment. Sir, my husband, who is in Company K, 22nd Regiment, U.S. Colored Troops, and now in the Macon Hospital at Portsmouth with a wound in his arm, has not received any pay since last May, and then only $13. Sir, we, the members of Company D of the 55th Massachusetts Volunteers, call the attention of Your Excellency to our case. For instant, look and see that we never was freed yet, run right out of slavery, in to soldiery, and we hadn't nothing at all, and our wives and mother, most all of them, is a perishing all about, and we all are perishing ourself. I am willing to be a soldier and serve my time faithful like a man, but I think it is hard to be put off in such doggish manner as that. Will you see that the colored men fighting now are fairly treated? You ought to do this, and do it at once, not let the thing run along. Meet it quickly and manfully. We poor oppressed ones appeal to you and ask fair play. So please, if you can do any good for us, do it in the name of God. Excuse my boldness, but please, your reply will settle the matter and will be appreciated by a colored man who is willing to sacrifice his son in the cause of freedom and humanity.
Tracy K. Smith, and one of the poems in Wade in the Water, I will tell you the truth about this. I will tell you all about it. Just a tiny section of that poem. We'll come back with more with Tracy and others in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tracy K. Smith is with us. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet laureate of the United States. And before we move on to added some additional guests into this conversation, that poem that you just read, composed of the actual words of African-American soldiers in the Civil War to the President Abraham Lincoln, you didn't change very many of those words, and yet they sound like poetry.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably one of the main reasons why I felt I can't do anything to this but gather. There's an urgency to those pleas, and in some cases, people, you know, they're resorting to the most emphatic language that they have access to.
Since you believe that poetry really can open minds and speak to people and make them consider things outside their own sphere of influence and their own experiences in life, I know that you are, obviously, you're African-American. Are you using your work as a poet, not just as a poet laureate, but as a poet, to explore and explain and open the world's eyes to the experience of African-Americans in America?
Well, I think what I'm really doing is trying to learn something for myself. So with this poem, I was asked, will you contribute a Civil War poem to this project? And I said, what do I know about the Civil War? Well, I know the debates that exist around it, but I don't know what it was like for actual people. And I'm really interested in what it was like for individual blacks, many of whom were enslaved as they fought. And so writing the poem, doing the research for the poem, allowed me to learn something. And that process is something I hope is transmitted to someone who reads the poem as well.
So I'm going to ask you to stay around here as we open this conversation up to some other folks here, because you're here because of Sensoria. As I said, you're speaking tonight at 8 at Peace Auditorium and 11 o'clock tomorrow at the Halton Theater on the campus at CPCC as part of the Sensoria Festival. And if poetry can speak to people and let them see themselves and each other in a different light and have a lasting positive effect on society, what can the combination of poetry and music do? And that's a question perhaps you'll get an answer to in another part of Sensoria. During their performance of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem, it was commissioned as a piece to mark the completion of the new Coventry Cathedral in England. After the old one was bombed in World War II, the old one had been there since the 15th century, and Benjamin Britten, the composer, was commissioned to write this work, but it was also a public statement of his anti-war convictions, and it uses the text of a poet, Wilfred Owen, an English soldier who wrote poetry based on the horrors of war and who was killed 4 days before the armistice in World War I. Joining us to talk about that is Maestro Alan Yamamoto, CPCC's Division Director of the Arts and former resident conductor for the Charlotte Symphony. You'll be conducting War Requiem, correct?
Absolutely.
Welcome to the program. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And Amy Bagwell is here. She's the board co-chair for literary events at CPCC's Sensoria Festival. Thank you for joining us, too.
Thank you.
We've been talking about how poetry can open your mind, et cetera. And that was, I believe, composer Benjamin Britten's goal when he wrote War Requiem. He had anti-war convictions, as I said. Could his music have transmitted those feelings without the words of the poet, Wilfred Owen?
Well, I think when you add any other discipline to music, you are reaching a bit further than music might be able to do on its own. So certainly the words of Owen, and remember that he's writing a Requiem Mass, which is sort of a goal for many master composers to write a work of this magnitude as part of their oeuvre. And so he certainly had to look at the past great Requiem Masses because he knew they would be compared, as we like to do in our human consciousness. And so he drew a lot of this from the Verdi Requiem, but I think in his adding the Owen poetry, he was definitely bringing to this genre something completely innovative that had not been done before, and made this piece a real social-political statement, which is, I think for Britten, not an unusual thing, and even in his being a pacifist and being having to go through a tribunal in Great Britain to be awarded a pacifist sort of a threshold so that he would not have to fight in the war, because he felt his work was important enough that he just shouldn't be, you know, eliminated by war, and that his work was important for the future. So yes, in this case, I think he very much wanted to bring, use music as a vehicle to bring sort of the community of mankind together through this work of art.
Why is writing a great Requiem Mass a benchmark for a classical music?
Well, I don't think people set out to say, I'm going to write a Requiem Mass. I think he was presented with an opportunity, and it was an opportunity of the magnitude that required a piece like this. He had tried to write one before with W.H. Auden, writing some of the lyrics, but it didn't work out. And you can read through history composers, near misses with famous other famous writers and artists, whether it's choreographers, et cetera, that don't work out, and you say, what would have been? But this is what came to him, and like a lot of us, and I'm sure it's true for Tracy as well, when she discovered the Civil War letters, that here was an opportunity, and you felt some connection, and as he did with the Owen poems.
The cathedral was destroyed in the early 40s, I think 1942. The piece premiered in 1962, so it's a fairly recent work. And it holds the distinction of being the best-selling classical music recording ever. Why? Is it because of something in the music? Is it because of the sentiment in the words that the poet wrote? Is it because of the collection of the two together? Why? Explain it.
I can't explain that other than to say it was timing is probably a lot of it, the point in history. Britten was a prominent composer in the way that when Tracy K. Smith writes her next book, people will be waiting for it. And he had achieved that threshold of notoriety in the Western music canon, and so people were waiting for it, and it was even declared a masterpiece before its premiere performance. So how good is that? Which he then had to, you know, he had to live with that. And it was the last large piece he ever wrote in his life.
I want to talk about the confluence of this performance, your performance of the War Requiem, and a lot of different anniversaries. It was 55 years ago this May that the recording, the most successful classical music recording of this piece, was released. 125 years ago this month, Wilfred Owen finished his most famous poem, and it was 9 of his poems that Benjamin Britten wove into this piece. And your performance falls on the 100th year anniversary of the end of World War I, which will be November the 4th, 2018. Is that why you chose this at this point for Sensoria?
Absolutely. We were looking for a way to acknowledge and commemorate the end of the war, to honor veterans as well. And we have another connection for us, which was to honor Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King, because it's the 50th anniversary of his assassination. And he, of course, spoke out in an unpopular way at the time about the Vietnam War. So we wanted to tie all this together.
Yeah, well, it should be pointed out that when Wilfred Owen wrote these poems, and he went to fight for his country, he wrote them because he, too, was a pacifist. And he wrote them from the point of view, if I understand this correctly, of somebody in the trenches of World War I, and he was writing about the horrors of World War I and the futility of war in general. And this was at a time when the propaganda machine that the government rolled out, and it comes from a tradition of fighting and dying for your country being a glorious thing to do. And because there was no mass media, a lot of the young boys going into these wars had no way of knowing what was about to hit them. They could not possibly have imagined it, and what did happen was being hidden from them because they needed to continue to recruit. So writing these poems at that time was incredibly going against the grain. He was killed, as I said, just 1 week before the armistice in November of 1918, and he said of his own poetry, "I am not concerned with poetry. My subject is war and the pity of war. The poetry is in the pity." That sounds very much like your philosophy. Am I wrong about that, Tracy?
Oh, I would want to align myself with that perspective. You know, the sense of we're bearing witness and the artful act is to position ourselves in such a way as to bear witness fully and fearlessly and empathetically, usefully. Yeah.
And he goes on to say that all a poet can do is warn. That is why true poets must be truthful. I understand that you are working on the libretto of an opera about the legacy of black land ownership in the current era of relentless development. Is there anything you think you can learn from or steal from the poet here or Benjamin Britten?
Well, you'll hear me listening, right? I'm like, what can I learn? I'm working with a composer that I have such faith in. His name is Gregory Spears. His most recent opera is Fellow Travelers, and I'm thinking about what language gets from aligning itself with music and how the sense of the mythic stakes that run through ordinary lives can be transmitted along, you know, the lines of music in addition to poetic language.
Musically, this is enormous. I mean, I don't even... did you start rehearsing this 5 years ago? Because it's the scope...
That would have been good. Yeah.
The scope is... It's scored for 3 soloists, a chamber orchestra, a full choir and a main orchestra, a boys' choir, and an organ that Benjamin Britten suggests you put in the wings so it sounds off in the distance. Are you performing all of these component parts?
Yes, we have all of the component parts, and we have a wonderful, this is a large community collaborative project. Our main partner is UNC Charlotte College of Arts and Architecture. Mm-hmm. And we want to thank them in particular for supporting the music department, especially in the chair there, for supporting this project and being our co-presenters. So they brought their entire chorus, their faculty, on the stage to perform. We also have the Queen's University chorus, our own CPCC chorus, as well as a number of people from Winthrop University, as far away as UNC Greensboro, South Carolina, Columbia, et cetera. So this has become a great community event.
The logistics of this sound like a nightmare. How
try not to use the nightmare
okay.
reference.
If you have a choir or pieces of a choir in Columbia, how do you rehearse it?
Well, this is a piece, unusually so, that you rehearse in pieces. So, yes, I've gone to each of these schools. I've rehearsed with those choruses in their own homes, and they only got together last night, as a matter of fact, for the first time. And it was, as you would expect, quite a challenging, wonderful moment of chaos for everybody. Looking around, because a lot of them hadn't realized there were these other component parts of the piece. So it's a great challenge in that way.
They didn't bother to listen to the recording?
Well, some may have been busy with other spring functions, but a lot did.
I should mention, of course, that Tracy's appearance here and also the performance of Benjamin Britten's War Requiem will all be on our website at WFAE.org. But the War Requiem will be performed Friday at 7 o'clock and Saturday at 7:30, both in the Halton Theater. Scholars recently found a scrap of paper in Benjamin Britten's personal archive, on which he wrote to a friend a description of the War Requiem as he was writing it. And on this scrap of paper, he wrote, "I am interspersing the Latin text with many poems of a great English poet, Wilfred Owen. These magnificent poems, full of the hate of destruction, are a kind of commentary on the mass." And in the piece, in addition to soloists who sing the words of Wilfred Owen's poems, the choir is singing more traditional Catholic Latin Mass. What is the effect of that? These two different languages and the reverence that would be in a Latin Mass versus the hatred he talks about in these poems for war.
Well, interestingly, I was watching the faces of the people who were not active at the moment in the rehearsal. And because they had not, most of them have never performed the piece, and so it's really from them I was beginning to learn what that reaction would be. And what I found was that the chorus members, who are primarily students, and I want to say that over half of our 175 performers are students on the stage, were actually mesmerized by the soloists and the poetry, which they had not read, even though we'd given them the text. But as I said, they're busy, and so they were very engaged with it. And then the chamber orchestra on the other side were equally engaged with the more ritualistic Latin utterings.
Amy Bagwell is here. She's the co-chair of the literary events part of Sensoria. This is an enormous festival that I don't think people know enough about. I mean, it's enormous.
It's enormous.
There are 90 events on 6 campuses over the course of 10 years, both visual and performing arts. What's the literary side of this in addition to Tracy K. Smith?
This grew from a literary festival that was founded 26 years ago, so the festival remains sort of centrally literary. We have Tracy K. Smith, which is wonderful, and poet and novelist John Pineda coming tomorrow. Mm-hmm. A number of events at area campuses, including Bryn Chancellor, was the other day out at Levine campus talking about her novel Sycamore. So we've interwoven literary events through the 10 days. It is the keynote central moment now and tomorrow, and then this beautiful musical combination this weekend kind of wrap up the literary bits of the festival. I did want to add to Alan's comment about the student participation in the Britten. We've looked this year at student involvement, and we have 1,200 students who are participating in terms of creating, performing, and presenting work. So it is an outward-facing festival that we want everyone in the community to come to. Most of the events are free. The ticketed events are very affordable. But it also does so much for the college and for the students because it's all interwoven into their curriculum, and they come as classes. So I appreciate your saying it's something that the community should know more about, because we're very proud and we love to have more people come in.
Well, 14,000 people came last year to see
That's
this,
right.
And you're hoping for more this year, and you have beautiful venues to put these things, to house these things. The Halton Theater is one of the nicest theaters in town. This goes on until the 15th of April, so there's still time to avail yourself of this, and you can get information about what the programming from this point forward is going to be about at Sensoria. That's Sensoria, sensoria.cpcc.edu. Amy Bagwell, thank you for being here. Alan Yamamoto, Tracy K. Smith, thank you all for the hour. It was great.
Thank you.